Right, welcome everybody. If I could just, before we start, ask you to please make sure your mobile phones are turned off before we go on. You always hear a few chirps at that point. First of all, let me please allow me to introduce myself. My name is Matt Mulford. I'm the Director of Academic Affairs for the TRIUM Executive MBA program. And I'd like to welcome everybody here to the LSE today. Now, some figures sometimes transcend their professions. They become icons, in a sense. And they become more than just a symbol of their respective field. They become kind of our mental image of what it is to be that something in that field. You can kind of think of Albert Einstein. If we think of a physicist, the image that's created in our mind is somehow a wiry-haired person with little glasses. And I think that if we think of management or a business leader, what we think of,
I don't like
is
where
Jack
this is
Welch.
Going. A short, bald guy.
I wasn't exactly going to say that. But our guest is probably the icon, I would say, of management and business leadership in the last century. He is in many people's minds the exemplar of what it is to be a CEO. And ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Jack Welch. Now, just to go over the schedule a little bit about how we're going to spend this next 50 minutes or so, I'm going to talk with Mr. Welch about 10-15 minutes in a dialogue, and then I'll open up to questions, and we'll have some questions and answers until about 4:30, at which time copies of Mr. Welch's new book, Winning, will be available outside, and people who would like to have it signed will be able to come back here with their copies and get a signed copy here on stage. Your iconic position as a kind of exemplar of the CEO has been, I'd say, further enhanced, if it were possible, by the publication of your book. And I just wanted to give a special thanks, or at least a recognition, to Susie Welch, if she's here.
She's there.
Because she wrote the book with
Stand
me.
Stand up.
Thank you very much. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to read the book, it is a very, very interesting book. It's a great book. If you've ever run anything or managed anyone, I think you'll find in it times where you stop and say, I wish I would have done that, or I'm going to start doing that right away. And I finished it recently, and my copy has more underlined bits than I care to mention. So I think I can't recommend it highly enough.
Thank you. Now, we ought to also say that the proceeds of this book all go to scholarships for inner-city kids, so we're not out here hawking books to make a living. So I just wanted to be sure we all knew that.
Your lifelong career at GE culminated in the job as a CEO. You, through that time, delivered consistent and therefore predictable growth. And that, after all, is what the market loves. So during your leadership, the company's market cap grew by $400 billion. Now, when you ran GE, it was arguably the most valuable and surely one of the biggest companies in the world. And my first question to you is, do you think that companies of that magnitude of size, and do their CEOs, have different normative responsibilities when they operate in the environment than they do than small companies? And if you do think they have different normative responsibilities, what do you think they are?
No, I don't think they do. I think that one of the luxuries of winning companies in general, which is what this book is about, is winning companies give back. The reason why winning is so good is winning companies pay taxes, their employees have secure jobs, they have an ability to mentor. We had 55,000 people in GE mentoring kids in the inner city. When the recent tsunami crisis came, our employees, within the first 24 hours, gave $2.5 million. Within the first 24 hours of Katrina, our employees themselves gave over $3 million. So winning companies have a spirit and a satisfaction that losing companies don't have. So people can say, why do you want to win? Like being in a locker room, do you want to be in the winning locker room or the losing locker room? What's the attitude? What's the atmosphere? What's the morale? I was over to the BBC, I think 2 days ago. They're going to have some layoffs over there. And the whole place is paralyzed. Sad people sitting in cubicles, hunched over. No one with a smile. Couldn't find a smile. That's a place that doesn't have direction, doesn't know. People aren't talking to each other. People aren't helping each other to know what's going to happen. That's what losing operations end up looking like. They don't end up helping anything. I mean that just as a metaphor for losing. You can go in the place and feel negativity. Just feel people feeling bad, unsure, insecure. Those are all the things. And great companies, large or small, have to provide an atmosphere where people are excited, where the work is great, where fun occurs, where celebrations occur, where rewards are given.
You presided over a great period of globalization in GE, and I just wondered, you've argued passionately and convincingly, I think, for the importance of integrity and playing by the rules in order to win within the rules. What about when companies have to operate in states with extremely weak or corrupt institutions? In those situations, who should make the rules, do you think?
The company. The company has to keep its compass. And you can be in countries and you can have your salespeople tell you, we can't get an order without bribing X or paying off Y. You just got to say, we're not getting the order. And guess what happens? Over time, people come to want to do business with straight companies. Over time, that's what they want. They don't want, because in the end, they don't know who's corrupt. In corrupt societies, it's the seal of, it's a good housekeeping seal of approval. That happened to us in Africa. It happened to us in lots of places where we lost business early and in the end got more business for it in the end. It was like a bureaucrat was okay to buy it because he knew he wasn't going to get in trouble in some investigation or something else. Now, you have to suffer through a lot of times when the salespeople are saying, oh, we're dead, we can't get it, and you lose them. But the company's policy has to overrule the country's, if you will, culture.
Well, on the other side, you have some countries with very weak or corrupt institutions and other countries that have very strong rules, but the rules that they have might not fit with our normative values. I just wonder...
Give me some examples.
Well, Burma, for example. I mean, I don't think people would argue that Burma has weak rules or weak institutions necessarily. I wondered what, if you could tell me, do you think multinational corporations' roles in those type of countries are to stay away, to actively engage? How should they, what do you think companies should do when confronted with that kind of potential market?
Very hard. It's easy for companies like GE to stay away because we're big enough. A small company trying to make a go of it, a Southeast Asian company, I wouldn't presume to tell them what to do as long as they played by the rules of the country and their company. A company like GE can afford to be a certain way because it's a $150 billion company with $20 billion of profits. You can... It's easier to make calls like that.
This is slightly personal. I mean, my wife's a doctor.
Yeah.
In the medical profession, there's a lot now written about evidence-based medicine. And it emerged out of consistent findings that showed when doctors kind of followed their gut instinct or their intuition and went against a treatment regime that would be recommended based on large-scale studies, that they often, the patients did worse. I wondered, in your book...
When they went with their gut.
When they went with their gut. In your book, Winning, there's a lot of very compelling kind of argument about how managers should mind their intuition, that if their intuition tells them that a deal is bad, even if the numbers say it's good, that back out. Or if you think it might be a bad idea, if your gut feeling is not to hire someone, then you shouldn't hire them, even if you don't have that kind of... There's no hard evidence for it. I just wondered if you thought that there was room in management for evidence-based management, or do you think that it's such a different type of activity that this kind of more empirical analysis...
I think it's so much different, so much broader, so much more situational. I mean, with all due respect, a doctor is dealing with a fixed entity, with fixed organs, and generally has more guidelines. But business is always a different situation. It's never the same. It's rarely the same. So my view of life is pattern recognition is one of your greatest skills. You see things, you try them, they work. Try it, go further the next time. Gain self-confidence in each one of them and reach out further. So I believe gut is an important part of business. Waiting for some strategic plan to come together with some crappy big fat book is a silly waste of time. Meanwhile, while you're doing it, somebody else is just taking your customers and practically your company. So I mean, I think you got to act on your gut. Have courage, particularly young graduates. I mean, the idea of having a degree from LSE here, being 35 or less, and being out there ready to swing, why the hell would you be cautious? I mean, it's outrageous to think you'd be cautious. I mean, you got a degree, you got a game, go for it. Try it. Start a business. Challenge the status quo in a company. Do all these things. Feel free to do it. It's because you got options. You got a degree. You got a credential. You got something.
There's been a lot of written about aligning CEOs' interests with the interests of the company. And in fact, it's a very old problem, the principal-agent problem that academics like us wrestle with all the time about how to create incentive structures to align those different incentives.
Oh, it drives you nuts, doesn't it?
It does. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you think a CEO's performance should be measured. And more particular, what kind of outside factors should kind of be controlled for when we evaluate them?
Well, clearly, we always looked at three things in measuring our business's success. Let's start with that. It was employee satisfaction, it was customer satisfaction, and it was cash flow. So those three measurements were the ones that you couldn't fool with. We surveyed our employees blindly every 6 months, surveyed our customers every 6 months, and cash flow you look at, not net income, that's art. Cash flow is what you count. As far as the CEO is concerned, is what kind of an atmosphere is he or she creating? Are they good citizens? Are they growing the enterprise? Are they providing wealth to share owners? Are they providing wealth to the communities they live in? Are their people thriving? I mean, one of the great things about our excitement at GE was we have four CEOs today that work for me who are running in the Dow Jones 30, the 4 out of 30. We have more than 50 CEOs in the Fortune 500. Work for us. That's exciting. So we created lots of leaders, we created lots of life. We had the other thing that's a huge kick is we have 65,000 people with stock options. There's nothing more exciting than every Friday we get the sheet of who cashed options. And you see a young engineer making $80,000 and cashes options for $400,000. You can bet your life they're going to have a great weekend. And you can also bet your life their life is going to change with kids and college and second homes and all that stuff. That's the kick of it all.
In this country and in Europe in general, there's been some controversy over CEO compensation.
Everywhere.
Do you think the market has done a good job at aligning compensation with performance?
Well, that depends on where you sit. Do I think free market should exist? Absolutely. Who else would set CEO pay or anyone else's pay? I mean, would it government? God, no. Would university professors? God, no. No, who would do it? I mean, free markets have excesses. We have Beckham getting stolen to go play in Spain because free markets existed. We have CEOs getting paid a lot of money. We have people who report to CEOs making a lot of money. If you look at the top five people in GE, they all made enormous money. We all made more than we ever dreamt we made. Don't forget, I came from a family with a father that worked on the railroad. Didn't have two nickels to rub together. I went to a school for $50 a semester. And it all worked out right. And that's what you want to have. You want to have lots of people have it work out right. You don't want to legislate it and sit on it. Now you'll have excesses, and you'll have stupidness, and you'll have bad performance. You'll have all those things. There's no right, but the best answer is a free market. We've seen other systems, they don't work. As bad as a free market sometimes looks, it's better than any other game in town.
You've written a lot about the 20-70-10 method of differentiation. For those of you who don't know, it's that you identify your top 20% of performers and you make sure that they're compensated and rewarded for their kind of star status. If I'm getting this wrong, please correct me.
No, you're doing fine so far.
70%.
I'd rather you do it than me. I've done it so many times.
The middle kind of 70% are the heart and soul of your company, and for them you try to create a situation where they can grow and improve. And the bottom 10% is written off, that they should be let go.
Yeah, and but they're never surprised. They've been appraised in a candid, transparent way. They know it's time for them to move on. You label them the bottom 10 so they know it. You don't give them 3% raises or 2% raises. They know where they stand. So 85% of them or more go on their own. You don't fire them. You tell them within a year, find something else. And no one wants to go somewhere where they're thought of as the bottom 10%. Now, what happens when people say, I'm too kind, I'm too nice a manager to ever label somebody in the bottom 10%? Who could possibly be so cruel as to do that? Well, let's take the case of a recession comes to a company. And the kind manager now is stuck with no sales, low sales, and a big cost structure. And they've got to reduce costs. So what do? They got to say, well, I got to take some people out. And they walk in and they say, Harry, sorry, you know how tough things are. You've been reading the paper. We've got to let you go. And Harry said, well, why me in this whole place? Why would you do it to me? And he said, well, you weren't that good, Harry. And Harry said, but I've been here 31 years and you never told me before. That's what the kind manager does. I maintain it's the cruelest form of management. The people that walk away from telling people, I'll bet in your classrooms here at LSE, you can identify who the best students are in your own classroom. You can know who the middle 70 are, and you can know the 10% that are just making it. That's what you're going to have to be doing all your life, is making those evaluations as you manage people, as you manage organizations. That's what sports teams do every day naturally. Your football teams take care of their best, try and get the middle to work well, and trade or let go the players that aren't doing well. Baseball, football is no different than business. It's a game. The team that feels the best players wins. It's that simple. The smartest, best players, that's the team that wins. So that's what you got to do. And you got to do it transparently. You got to do it where you tell people. You don't whisper it to somebody else. Oh, God, Mary's awful. She's just terrible. But you and I know, but let's not tell her. Can't do that. You have an obligation. As a manager, you have an obligation to let your people know where they stand. It's your responsibility.
Did you ever have difficulty distinguishing individuals' contribution and team contribution?
No. I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, I think, how many people in this class are in school now? How many people here in this room tonight are in school? Okay, we got a lot of hands up. How many of you, if pressed, could tell who the best 20% of your class was? Smartest, if pressed. Only a couple of you could evaluate your people. I say your careers are limited, I'll tell you that right now. If you can't identify the best people in your class, you got real problems.
They've just started, so give them a couple weeks. Do you think management training should be largely vocational or professional?
Give me the difference.
Well, vocational training, probably you start out with not a lot of theory, I would guess, and it's mostly about doing. And you follow a mentor around, and you kind of see how they do things, and you then, after a long period of kind of practice, you're given a license to go and, I don't know, plumb somebody's house. Professional training usually has that last bit on it, but also has a long period of kind of theoretical background. Do you think that theoretical background part is necessary in management?
I think it's helpful, but not necessary. I think it's, I think without question, but you raised one issue I'd like to jump on if I could a minute. You raised the issue of a mentor. Whatever you do in your business career, don't get a mentor. It's the worst idea ever invented in business. Guess what? Your mentor can be a turkey. And you're stuck with your mentor. You want to see everyone as a mentor. You want to see media as a mentor. You want to see speakers come in and be mentors at times. You want to see all kinds of people. You want to be open to learning from everywhere. You don't want to get the direct training. I mean, companies that do that really pigeonhole people. And they end up looking like the person they're following around. Well, that person might not be a star, might not have the right values, might not be right. See everybody as a mentor. Search, be insatiable in your desire to learn from each other, from people. That's what will make you a great person. Know you're not the smartest. Know when you're in a company that everything you're doing, somebody's doing better. Somebody else is doing better. And then go find out exactly what it is. Companies love to share information. Companies are open to sharing information. Companies will have you come in, and we learn more about manufacturing and inventories from Toyota than we ever could do ourselves. We learn more about customer satisfaction from Walmart than we ever knew ourselves. I mean, going out and learning is what it's all about. So that's the mentoring side. As far as the, I think it's a blend of both. I think the idea of coming to a school like this and a graduate degree, it gives you a chance to compare yourself. It gives you another notch on your belt in terms of experience, interacting with smart people, smart peers. I think it's extremely useful from that. I don't think, I can't say this school, I can say business schools in general do not spend enough time on the human resource equation. They talk about all kinds of theoretical strategy courses and all these other courses, when in the end, guess what? Your whole job is human resources. That's all you'll do if you lead. You won't be studying disruptive technologies, I'll tell you that. And some professor's little niche hobby that they'll try and drown you with, it won't be worth a damn. So you're going to be dealing with people. You're going to be leading people. You're going to be exciting people. You're going to be laying out where to go. You're going to be doing it. That's what you're going to be doing. So the more courses, the first school we've seen do this, and LSE may be doing it, the only school we've seen so far, and this is our 25th school, the only school we've seen so far is Dartmouth. At Tuck School, they've instituted a class now where their students have to give each other 360 evaluations, have to appraise each other, and then have to face the students with the evaluations. And I think it's fabulous training. Fabulous training, because that's what happens to you within 3 years of getting out. I'll guarantee you, that's what you do. You hire, you remove, you challenge, you engage, you excite, you energize, all those things. You don't do this other stuff.
This is my last question. Towards the back of the book, you say, if you were starting out in business, you give some advice to people just starting in their careers. And one of the things you say is you would learn as much about China as you possibly can because it's going to be a dominant issue in your professional life. I just wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what makes China so unique, say, versus India.
No, I think they're both.
Both.
I think you'll have in the next 30 years three dominant economic powers, the U.S., and China vying for number one, and India a strong number two. That's my view of the way the world's going to work out. It's going to be that way. I mean, now China's not going to have a straight line on the way up, there's no question. Because, I mean, they've got too many problems to solve. They've got a legal system to clean up. They've got a private enterprise that's overtaken the state companies now. And how long is the state company going to allow that? So the genie's out of the bottle and they're going to have to manage it. But you only have to go back 200 years to where China and India had half the GDP of the world. you know, that's the interesting part of this whole thing. Everyone thinks China's emerging. China's emerged before and before and before. And in the early 1800s, China and India were the dominant forces in commerce in the world. And you're going to see that again. You got great people, smart people, energetic people, and they're going to really deliver.
Thank you very much for being patient with me.
You were great.
As were you. I think we'll open it up to question and answers now. There's a lot of people here, and I realize that many of you will have questions to ask, so may I please ask you to keep them short? Is there microphones available, or are you just going to have you shout out? The microphone's available.
Well, do either one.
So anybody?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes. You know, I guess the way I describe Russia is the only time you like regulation is when you go to a country that doesn't have it. No, I mean, the real fear, what are the rules? What are the rules and who governs them? And that, I think, is the question for countries like Russia to deal with.
Up at the top here.
Can an organization move from being a losing organization to a winning organization without the CEO changing?
You know, that's a tough question. It depends on the circumstances, obviously. But I would say a fresh start clearly gives you an easier path to victory than trying to take a retread and make it work. So I would argue if a company is going downhill, you need a change at the top to make it turn around. I would vote for that. 80% of the time. I'm not sure it's 100% absolute, but I would sure vote for that. Yes, anybody just?
Can I ask what three things do you wish that you had known when you were, say, 22, 23, 24, say the average age of this audience, that you now know?
Move faster. Ponder less, act. More about the world, the customs, the different behaviors country by country. Not a hell of a lot, actually.
Just as a follow-up to that, do you think people can boldly go the wrong direction?
Absolutely. I'll never forget having dinner in Eindhoven with the chairman of Philips several times removed. They change it about every two or three years. Several times removed. And it was a rainy, foggy night in Eindhoven. And we had this dinner at the Philips house, and he was describing his strategy. He was going to get out of this business. He was going to get out of the medical business. He was going to get out of this business. And he was going to put all his money in semiconductors. He was going to put all his money in other. And I got in the car with my partner, Paolo Fresco, who was my vice chairman. And we're driving through the dark night of Amsterdam with the rain beating down the car. And I looked at him and I said, one of us is going to get our ass fired here any day now. Because I was getting out of semiconductors. I was getting out of everything he was getting into. And he was getting into everything I was getting out of. And he was as sure as I was about which way we were going. I said, one of us is going to get shot. I hope it isn't us. So, yes, absolutely. And you've seen companies go down ditches. You've seen Corning bet its whole company on one thing and then have to recover and come back. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You've seen some of the telecom companies here have some of these troubles.
Hi, my name is Colin Ganley. Have you read Jim Collins' book, Good to Great?
Yes.
Okay, I've got a question about that book. I actually read it first in the Harvard Business Review, a review on the Level 5 Leadership. And in Level 5 Leadership, which is a concept in that book, he talks about the blending of extreme personal humility with professional sort of drive. And he likes to make a comparison in that book about if you had purchased $1 worth of stock in GE in 1981 when you took over, and had purchased $1 worth of stock in Circuit City, one of the companies he profiles in that book, that you would be 6 times better off with the Circuit City stock.
And have you seen Circuit City lately?
No, not recently. I'd just like to know what you think accounts for that. I mean, you know, it's a 20-year case study, and I'm curious to know what you think accounts for that difference. Was GE maybe not great, but just good? Or was there some other reason? Did it have anything to do with leadership style, since that's what your past two books have been on?
Well, Jim Collins' book celebrates the team versus the leader, if you will. Some of his companies, Mead, for example, a suspect today. You should look at all companies that are there today now. That's 5 years after the books were published. I think in general you have a lot of good ideas in that book about level five leaders, about all the level leaders he had. But I think it had flaws like every other, like this book. This book here isn't the perfect book. This book here has a lot of things to debate. The reason for writing this book is, and people are using it this way, is to take the chapters and decide whether you believe in candor or not, or too much or too little. Take the budgeting method we propose and say, do we like our budgeting method or that budgeting method, and which one is better? So each book has their own things. This book is a management philosophy. Jim Collins is a study of selected group of companies that fit a model that he wanted to make. This is just a management philosophy underneath it. This is a totally different book. Totally different. Remember the book, you're too young, that Peterson Wasserman wrote on 10 great companies, that companies are the excellence? In search of excellence. Most of those companies have blown up now. Jim Collins' companies are having some of the same problems. Picking companies at any one moment in time is a very tricky game, from this point to this point, this point to this point.
Hi. You talk about moving faster and about the notion of pondering less, both in Straight from the Gut and now. And part of the thing that, coming from the student side of it, over here, is it takes a while to master the tools of any organization. You talked about in Straight from the Gut going from boundaryless to Six Sigma and so on. Is there a certain kind of personality that's capable of making the changes as fast as they come along and mastering those things? Or can anybody, you know, given the right set of right culture and right circumstances, capable of operating an organization that's constantly on the move, constantly retooling, and constantly reexamining itself?
Well, see, I would argue that as far as tools are concerned, we would be the exception to rapid change. Most companies make the mistake of flavor of the month. In the 20 years I was there, we had 4 initiatives. So 5 years of in-depth in each one, just about. That's pretty much plenty of time to dig in and keep learning on it. I mean, globalization's a classic example. We started globalizing. We went to India, for example, and we went there to sell product and found out the bureaucracy was slow, the economy was developing slower than we thought, but we found something else because we were there, we were working. We found all this intellect, all these bright people, all these terrific workers. So we ended up creating an intellectual capital in India for ourselves, employing now some 35,000 people in India because we found the brains, not the business. And we've been able to create all kinds of opportunities in that fabulous country because we were able to be there for a long period of time, a long bet. The thing you're talking about is this helter-skelter, Six Sigma to this, to that. That didn't happen in GE. It doesn't happen in GE. They go in depth, everything they do, and perhaps a little slower than you'd like. But the companies that, the difference between long initiatives and tactics is night and day. And I think NGE initiatives carry the day.
But maybe one from down here?
Yeah. He sounds like me. I mean, it's exactly the stuff I used to get told all the time. I'd say be comfortable in your own shoes. Be yourself, but don't be stupid. Don't throw it in somebody's face. But on the other hand, don't change to be somebody else. Because in the end, you want to be yourself when you get the next job. You don't want to be an imposter. You don't want to be in somebody else's shoes. But, you know, you can't be stupid about it either. So, but I like him. I'd hire him tomorrow. The characteristics you told me about. Because you can get that out of somebody. In the end, humility comes to people with time. He'll get punched in the nose a few times. He'll fall off the horse a few times. And when you fall off the horse, it's how well you get back on again. I mean, I've fallen off the horse several times. And each time you fall off, you get a little more humble. So he's probably not had, he probably had a pretty straight line. And he'll get whacked. but don't kill it. Don't take the stuff that's got him where he, you know. Yes, sir.
Sector ought to be applied to governments. Should they and can they?
The answer to the last one is absolutely not. I mean, that's the problem. I was speaking last night to a group, 1,000 people or so, at a meeting here in Central Hall, and a lovely young woman from the government got up and she said, "Mr. Welch, I really need some help from you." She said, "I really need advice how to handle." She worked in a ministry somewhere. And the crowd was waiting in bated breath for my answer. And I said, "I'm sorry, I can't help you. I can't. None of the tools I'm talking about in this book work in a non-meritocracy. They just don't work. So what I'm talking about only works in the private sector. Now, trying to engage people and excite them and celebrate a bit, yeah. How much? I don't know. I don't know. I sure as hell wouldn't want to try. It's just a tough environment. I teach principals, young principals in the New York City school system. We have a class of 100 who come in. We teach them for 14 months. They give up weekends. They're called aspiring principals. We've graduated 3 classes. That'd be 300 people. We have 1,200 principals in the New York City school system. The union is impossible. The union is impossible. We don't have control of the corridors. Now, the teachers will not go to the corridors. They've been negotiated out. The teachers will not go to the playground at recess. That's been negotiated out of the contract. So we have policemen with the kids out there. We have no hallways, no homeroom. Imagine coming to school at 8 years old with no homeroom. Just walk into the halls of a school. Because of the union. The teachers union in America is killing our education system, really killing it. Where no merit can be given, the teacher salaries are too low, they're too flattened. Merit, there's no merit, none whatsoever. And so these principals that leave us excited, charged up, ready to go in and apply these principles, quickly get a punch right in the nose. It's tragic. So until governments recognize a lot of what private enterprise does, I think we got real problems.
Up here now? Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, is there ever a situation where for a winning company, where a company winning is a negative factor.
Why don't you suggest one for me? Give me an example. They didn't win. They're in jail. They didn't play by the rules. Bad guys didn't play by the rules, outside the system, in jail.
Tobacco company?
What?
Walmart.
Oh, let's take Walmart. I think Walmart totally plays by the rules. I admire Walmart. I think they do great things in cities. They've created terrific jobs, lots of places. They employ over 1.5 million people. They've kept inflation down with global pricing. They've made more Americans live a better lifestyle because they could buy clothes and other things less expensively. Walmart, to me, is a great company. Home Depot's a great company. I think your retailer was a Tesoro. I think they're, from what everything I gather, they're a hell of a company.
They're the most food company in the world.
Probably. For what?
I mean, in ex-employees doing Walmart. There's a lot of small businesses that put out.
No, they don't sue them. Companies that have, employees that have left may have sued them. I don't know. They may be the most because they employ the most. We all get sued when we sack somebody wrong. So if they've got 1,750,000 people, that's a fairly large population, as they have grievances against them. No, I think they're a great company, run by great people that have given great opportunities, and most of all, given consumers a chance to live better lives by better pricing.
Can I just follow up on the firing people wrong? One of the things in the 20-70-10 that I found interesting, many of the evaluative systems that you have, for example, you talk about resistors and people who fail to energize others. And as I understood it from the book, these would be two very kind of big strikes against you if you were in a management position. And I can see exactly where the motivation for that would come from. But at the same time, I wonder how you avoid legal situations on such qualitative measures. If you say to somebody, you aren't an energizer, and they say, well, I energize people all the time,
Well, you don't do it because you say you don't energize people. That's not why. You didn't get results. I mean, you put results around it along with the energizer. You can't go in and say, hey, you're an energizer. You're not an energizer. Go home. No, you've got to put around it. That's one of the values, and over here is the performance, and it's a grid.
I see.
Each side. As far as resistance is concerned, you might run into some problems. Most of the time we talk about resistance, you talk about it in the acquisition phase. And I always advise people, if they're acquired by somebody, that the acquiring company will always pick someone who likes the new plan over somebody who blocks the new plan with brains. So somebody with lower brains but team player gets picked every time over the person who the person just spent $6 billion to buy the company, and you walk in and everybody's going, we don't like this at all, this stinks, you know? Wham! Get them out. And you can't fool with those people. You can't fool with those resistors, because you're on a strategy and a mission to go fix the two companies together. And resistors have got to, but they go elsewhere.
There's one over here, up here in the pink.
Never think, back to that question up there, never try and lose. Never.
Mr. Welsh, one of your great achievements surely is the appointment of Jeffrey Immelt. I've been checking out his pages on the website, GE website, and I must say GE stock must be an incredible investment at the moment with the strategy that he's developing in healthcare and in water generation, etc. It must be incredible for you to have the pride you must feel in Mr. Immelt, and also must be very unusual. It is very unusual for successful business people like yourself to appoint a successful person to follow on from them, and that really perhaps is 50% of the legacy. But I love both your books. In fact, I crashed my boat after staying up to 4 a.m. reading your latest one. It's a fantastic book. But successful businessmen usually say, looking back, that family is the most important thing. It's not just the go, go, go of business. So what about family and having the time to be a new man in a feminist world?
A new man in a
feminist world.
That's a question I don't know where to go with. How would you answer that? I think you get, I'm not saying 5 a.m. or whatever it is. If you can work efficiently your way and effectively, that's all somebody wants out of you in a company. But you've got to understand that you have a, we talked about China and India before you. I don't think, based on my 21 years in China and the last 2 years in China, that they're spending a lot of time on work-life balance. I don't see it. And so you've got a competitive world that we have to fight. Your way may be the perfect way, with information, with knowledge, to be able to get there. I don't know the answer. I think all I know is we got to be competitive and develop winning companies and products and services. If we do it with less manual effort, so much the better. But in the end, we got to move up the food chain, or we'll get killed.
Question from down here.
I think the I don't know enough about the UK education system, except I know they have a great university system. The US has a great university system. Our primary education is very spotty. We are not doing a good enough job in the inner city. That's where I'm working now. And we just do not have enough. We have so much resistance to doing it right. We're trying to get charter schools. The union's stopping us. Charter schools would be schools where merit teaching would go on, where pay would be better, where we'd get a better class of teacher. We could move kids at their own pace. You know, I think we have real problems. In the U.S., education is our Achilles heel right now, except we have a great university system that, in fact, if we get the cream of the crop there, we're able to get it. But to bring along enough of our society, we've got to improve the inner-city schools in America. And it's been an intractable problem for the last 20 years.
Mr. Welch, I used to work with GE in India, had a great time there. But there was one problem that we used to struggle with all the time. There were some of these principles that were handed down from top management, for example, Six Sigma, which sort of got distorted by the time they reached the execution level. It just sort of became a factor of what the black belt's target was, rather than whether the problem area for the green belt project was really worth it. So what do you think is the way to at least control this kind of breakdown what it is supposed to be to what it comes down to?
Look, you desperately want it to get down there the right way, but I usually comment in a speech, if I took all the savings that Black Belts presented me from Six Sigma projects, I would have the gross domestic product of the United States as the earnings for GE from the cost savings of the projects. Look, any system in a bureaucracy of 350,000 people doesn't translate everything perfectly. The fact that you got Six Sigma, black belts were working on projects, some of them weren't the right ones that you would have directed them to, that's pretty good, actually. We got close. I mean, it is a tough thing to drive an initiative down through 350,000 people so that they do it. India, though, in general, we had great success with Six Sigma. I mean, in those backroom processing operations, I don't know if you were there or if you were in R&D, but in the backroom processing operations, I mean, we had tremendous results for starting up out of nothing there and getting to like 15, 18,000 people. And we've just spun it off now as a public company. So obviously it wasn't perfect in your case, but we drove the message over. You heard the message till you couldn't stand listening to it, I'm sure. But it isn't always perfectly implemented by any means.
What do you think of corporate social responsibility in big companies, especially now? I think that CEOs don't have just to deal with internal people and customers, but also with society.
Look, that's why you want to win. Corporate responsibility begins, as Milton Friedman says, with winning. Because if you win, you have the resources to give back. Who are the leading companies now in the Katrina thing? Walmart, Pfizer, Home Depot, GE, all volunteering, sending people down, doing things, pouring money in. Corporations gave $250 million in the first 6 days. They gave tons of people. That's corporate responsibility. But if a company's going broke and the morale is terrible, you're not going to get it. So corporate responsibility starts with winning companies. And then, for example, I may have mentioned the 55,000 mentors in GE that mentored inner city schools. These people became almost parents for some of these kids, and they were prouder of the kids than they were some of their products at work. But they had the time to do it, they had the job security to do it, the company was winning. That's where a company can't say, I have social responsibility, and lose. They have nothing to give. It starts with winning. When you win, then it all flows. Look, governments, remember one thing. Governments generate nothing. They get all their money from your taxes or your revenues in some form. They create no money. So they allocate your money to the social responsibilities that the society needs. But it comes from your work and companies' work. Government work is there on your payroll. You got to get that straight. Now, I'm not saying governments don't do great things. They judge us. They teach us. They do all kinds of things. The judicial system, the educational system, that's all good from government. That public institutions of learning are great. Public education is fabulous in secondary education in countries. But it comes from winning companies and winning employees. It doesn't come from government. Some people think it starts there. People actually think government makes something. They don't do anything. They give it out from you. It's a transfer of money from you to them and then an allocation based on who you elect and how you elect them. But it all starts from an engine of an economy and winning companies. No matter what you might think, government does nothing but allocate your money. And I'll debate anybody that wants to debate here for the next 10 minutes about the subject. Yeah?
Customer satisfaction, employee satisfaction, or cash flow?
You need all three. You need all three. You need engaged employees. You desperately need engaged employees. You desperately need customers that trust you and think they'll win because of you. Your job as a supplier is to make your customers winners. And thirdly, cash flow is the one thing you can't fool with. Enron, for example, had no cash flow. So all the smart analysts weren't looking at Enron that way. They were all cheering them on the other way. They had no cash flow.
Okay, last question,
hi,
I'm afraid.
Here, upstairs. Hi. I would just like to ask you briefly about accountability, because obviously with things we talked about, such as Enron, it is somebody's fault. To what percentage do you think the CEO is accountable for the things that happen within the company? And if things go wrong, should the CEO be kicked out?
It depends. It's the situation. Obviously, something at Enron was manipulation at the highest level. Clearly, Globecom, manipulation at the highest level. Tyco, manipulation at the highest level. If you're running a 300-person company and you have somebody steal some copper from a vendor, you can't throw out the CEO. You got to be sure you have the systems in place to punish the perpetrator. So I think it varies. If the you know when the CEO is responsible. The CEO sets the wrong tone, and bad behavior is condoned. The CEO's got to go. You got to have a board of directors that's thoroughly engaged, not engaged in running the business, engaged in understanding employee satisfaction, has courage, good judgment, and is constantly working down in the organization. You want boards not to be going to lunches at the corporate headquarters. You want boards who are down in factories, walking the floor, talking to employees. Is what they're hearing in the boardroom the same as they're feeling on the factory floor? We set our board out 3 times a year to visit factories without us. Just go out, visit offices, go places, and we didn't go. And get a feel for what the employees feel so they can talk to them. That's what boards should do. The idea of boards and ending up in these ridiculous boardrooms, getting a pitch on PowerPoint slides about stuff that a CEO is mouthing off is not what a board should be doing. A real active board, is not micromanaging the business. They're taking the pulse of the company and using their good judgment and their character to weed out bad actors.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. If you enjoyed this afternoon's discussions, I'm sure you will love the book because it's full of the same insights and energy that Mr. Welsh showed us today. So I think I speak for everyone that a heartfelt gratitude for spending your time with us today, and I appreciate it very much.
And I thank you for being here. Thank you so much.
Just one more thing. After your comments about the state and the efficacy of the state or non-efficacy of the state in creating money, I don't know if this list will mean much, but a traditional gift for speakers at the LSE is an LSE hat, which has been given to Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Nelson Mandela, and Kofi Annan, all government bureaucrats, I'm afraid.
But no, I hope government leaders.
Leaders, but I hope you'll accept it as a token of
I
our
do
appreciation.
And I thank you very much.
All right. Yay. Great. Remember, books are available outside, and if you want to bring them back up here, Ms. Welch has agreed to sign them. But thank you very much for coming.